The Tom Woods Show, episode 1353.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, don't forget my friend Bob Murphy has an amazing new book where he takes all his critiques of Paul Krugman from over the years, all these devastating smashes, and organizes them in one volume according to topic. And these are topics you want to master, and Bob will help make you the master of the universe. Check it out at ContraKrugmanBook.com, and I am the narrator of the audiobook version, and you can get that for free when you check out the Audible offer at TomWoodsAudio.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I was looking over the list of episodes recently, and I was surprised at how little attention I've devoted on the show to the New Deal, which is a very, very important moment in American history and very important for libertarians to get right, because almost everybody gets that period wrong. So I thought, I've got to rectify this somehow. Now, I did have Bert Folsom on to talk about his great book, New Deal or Raw Deal. So I'll link to that and whatever else I've done on the New Deal on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1353. But what I decided to do today, particularly because last night I was traveling all day and I got back and had the worst headache, and I never have headaches. And just no matter what I did, it wouldn't go away, and I just had to go to sleep. So I'm going to share with you, this will be fun, excerpts from the Ron Paul curriculum, my government course. I've done about 400 video and audio files for the Ron Paul curriculum, Western civilization, pretty much from the ancient Hebrews and then ancient Greece and Rome. So that includes discussion of Plato, Aristotle, the main thinkers, the culture, the political history, all that stuff, all the way up to the present. That was quite a project. So I'm going to draw from the New Deal material there, and bear in mind that in this, I'm really having to go against the grain of the way the New Deal is typically described. And what I try to do in these lessons is say, now look, this is the standard way that people think about such and such, but here's another way to think about it, because normally you get one way. Franklin Roosevelt was a great guy, and wasn't the New Deal terrific? But the thing is, forget the textbooks, the authors who write the specialized studies, like even Doris Kearns Goodwin says that, okay, let's admit the New Deal obviously did not lift the country out of the Depression, but it gave everyone hope. That's the new fallback position they now have when they can no longer get away with claiming that the New Deal got the country out of the Depression. The fallback position is it gave us hope. All right, well, come on now, right? So then if that's true, if even they aren't going to defend the New Deal really on the merits, then I think I'm at liberty to go through and say, this is the logic of the programs involved, and so these were the consequences. And yeah, it may seem like I have a bias, but I don't understand. I think it's just a reality-based bias in this case, because if you have the National Industrial Recovery Act, and I'll discuss that in what's about to come in just a minute here, then I don't see how any of that, how could possibly help the country by artificially reducing the amount of stuff produced and raising prices. How could that help? There's almost no way you could even conceive of that helping, which is why today when people talk about the New Deal, they don't mention that, even though that was the signature program of the New Deal. They want to talk instead about Social Security and whatever else. They don't really want to talk about that. They certainly don't want to talk about the agricultural programs. I think we do need to talk about those things. So that's what I do here. I start with Herbert Hoover, run through the stock market crash, then go into the Depression and the New Deal. So if you would like to get this course, there are three ways of doing it. One is, of course, by just signing up for the Ron Paul curriculum, and then you can choose this as one of the courses. That's ronpaulhomeschool.com. Secondly, if you don't feel like signing up for the Ron Paul curriculum, but you'd just like to get the courses that I created, another way to do it is to go to tomwoodshomeschool.com, and that way you can get these courses a la carte without having to join the Ron Paul curriculum. Then a third way is to join libertyclassroom.com at the master level, and these courses are included as a bonus. And then finally, another way to get them is by becoming a supporting listener of the show at the gold level or above, and you get these courses as a bonus that way. That's over at supportinglisteners.com. So at tomwoods.com/1353, I will also list the ways you can grab this course, And here we go.
All right, so today we're going to talk about the Great Depression and the New Deal. Now, the Great Depression, of course, was a period that began, we usually date it with the stock market crash at the end of 1929 and then persisting for years afterward. The Great Depression, you know, when did it really end? That's a dispute. I would say that it didn't really end until after World War II. It didn't really end until 1946 because the so-called prosperity of World War II was fake prosperity. So the Depression really lingered and lingered. Now, we're not going to talk here about what the causes of the Great Depression were. You can read about that in Murray Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression. I have a chapter on it in my book, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. But having watched the lesson in this course on business cycles, you know about why it is that the economy goes up and down, and you've got interference with interest rates, et cetera. Well, that was all going on during the 1920s, and finally the thing came crashing down. So really what we've already talked about in what I think it might have been lesson 36 was on display here and was responsible for the Great Depression. That's talked about, as I say, in that Rothbard book. And then from the European side, you could read Lionel Robbins's book, The Great Depression. These are not easy reads, I warn you. You can, as I say, my chapter in 33 Questions is probably a little bit easier to follow. But the point is that once the Depression set in, things were pretty bad in the United States. In 1932, they were especially bad. 1931-32 were the really bad years, where unemployment was hitting 25%. In some parts of the country, it was 50% or more. In some areas, it was devastating in terms of production and growth and employment. Horrible. So what we're going to look at is what the government's response was. And it turns out that before the Great Depression, all other depressions saw the government intervening, not at all. The first time the government says, we're going to roll up our sleeves and try and fix this thing, we wind up with the longest depression in American history. All right, so in this lesson, we're going to talk about Herbert Hoover. So let me define some terms here and set the stage for you. First of all, the term the New Deal refers to a series of government programs that were implemented under the president who came after Herbert Hoover, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And the New Deal got started in 1933 and then just persisted throughout the tenure of Roosevelt. The New Deal is sometimes credited with lifting the economy out of the Depression. This is certainly untrue. And in fact, a number of historians now no longer try to claim that the New Deal lifted the country out of the Depression. What they say is that, well, the New Deal and the fireside chats that Roosevelt would give over the radio to the public increased the confidence of the American people. They comforted the American people. They didn't in and of themselves solve the problem, but they showed that the government was actively engaged in trying to solve the problem. Well, okay. But we'll be talking about Franklin Roosevelt, though, in the next lesson. In this lesson, we're going to talk about Hoover. And the conventional wisdom, just so again, I can set the stage for you, the conventional wisdom, the standard view that you will see to this day repeated in newspapers and elsewhere in the media, and et cetera, is that Herbert Hoover was a stupid stick in the mud who believed deeply in the free market economy. And because of that, he didn't lift a finger to try to turn things around when the Depression hit. Instead, he stuck to his guns and refused to help, and so naturally the economy got worse and worse. And then Franklin Roosevelt took over, and things got better and better and better, and that was because he got the government involved. Well, things didn't get that much better. They got somewhat better under Franklin Roosevelt. And in fact, the recovery, economic recovery, had already begun under Hoover and was simply maturing under FDR anyway. But from 1933 to 1940, that period of Roosevelt's term, the average unemployment rate was still 18%, so still not particularly great. Well, it turns out that now most historians recognize that this silly rendition of the facts that you'll read in the New York Times and other unreliable outlets is completely at odds with reality. that in fact Herbert Hoover had long since abandoned his confidence in the absolute free market economy. I have many quotations about this in my 33 questions about American history you're not supposed to ask. I have many quotations from Hoover in which he says that, of course, we don't believe in the laissez-faire free market economy anymore. Of course, we know that government needs to have a guiding hand on things. Like, who believes in the free market anymore? I mean, he was quite open about this. And as we'll see at the end of this lesson, his political opponents recognize this too. His political opponents said, oh my gosh, I can't believe Herbert Hoover is intervening so much in the economy. And he's expanding government power so much, he thinks, to fight the Depression. And he's actually making things worse. Franklin Roosevelt himself, when he ran against Herbert Hoover, said, my gosh, Herbert Hoover is spending too much money. We need to get in and balance the budget. So I'm not making this up. His own opponents saw this at the time. All right, so let's go through some of the specific examples of things that Hoover did. Now, I'm not going to go through absolutely everything that he did. There's a very, the most readable, easy part of Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, which you can get online for free, are the sections going through Hoover's policies, not going through the issues of the money supply growth in the 20s and business cycle theory, but the chapters on what Hoover did are just fantastic. So I'm just picking out a few, but they'll be enough to serve the purpose. The first one is his high wages policy. We begin to see already in 1930, from 1929 through 1930, Franklin Roosevelt convening meetings at the White House in which he would call major representatives of big business in and say to them, don't cut wages during this depression. Don't cut back on wages. Now, this was a time when prices were falling 10%, 15% a year, but keep wages stable. Now, this is in effect basically giving people a raise, in effect, right? If wages are falling, I beg your pardon, if prices are falling and wages stay the same, you're giving everybody a raise during a depression. Well, what this is going to do is make it harder to employ them. So business firms, by and large, the big businesses, kept their word. They pledged to the president they would not lower wage rates. Now, this sounds great, right? Everybody thinks, oh, good, right? People will have high wages. The problem is not a lot of people had wages. Now, the problem was that a lot of people had no wage at all because in the depressed conditions of the Depression, it was hard for business firms to afford to pay people what they used to pay them. And so a lot of people simply had no job at all. Now, the smaller businesses where there wasn't as much government scrutiny were probably getting away with modest decreases in wage rates. But by and large, economic commentators at the time noted that business firms were indeed keeping wage rates high. Something called the Alexander Hamilton Institute actually said that wage rates being kept at their previous high levels were a major ingredient in the continuing business recession. Other economists like Jacob Viner said, well, look, if we could create prosperity by keeping wages high, why don't we create more prosperity by doubling or tripling wages, right? Why be stingy? Why not double or triple wages if that's the key to prosperity? And because that's what Hoover said, if you keep wages high, then people will have more money to spend on goods, and that'll be great. Well, why don't we give them even more money to spend on goods, double their wages, triple their wages, then think of how much money they'll have in their pockets. Well, of course, the problem will be hardly anybody will be employed, so it'll defeat the whole purpose of the program. Now, at UCLA recently, in the past 20 years or so, economists Lee Ohanian and Harold Cole have written articles on this general subject, and they say that behind the scenes what was going on was that, in effect, the Hoover administration was pledging to give some of these business firms help against unionization of their firms in exchange for keeping wages high. And so there was a coercive element in the background to the high wage policy. So we've got the high wage policy. Franklin Roosevelt will take the high wage policy and make it actual government policy through his National Industrial Recovery Act, and the various industries of the American economy will see that there will be minimum wages established by law, not by the president trying to persuade you to do it as Hoover did, but actually forcing you to do it. We'll see that in the next lesson. Then in 1930, we get the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which raises tariffs, which are taxes on goods that are imported from other countries, on 25,000 products. It raises them an average of 59%. And when that happens, Americans buy fewer goods from foreign countries. So foreign countries tend to respond to that and say, well, if Americans now don't want to buy our goods because there are big taxes on them, then we're going to put taxes on American goods and make sure that our people don't buy American goods. So American cars, their sales in foreign countries fell sharply. A lot of goods Americans sold overseas fell sharply in sales in retaliation for the Smoot-Hawley tariff. So, as I say, since American consumers decided with an average 59% tax on imports not to buy imports, well, then other countries are going to say, well, then we're not going to buy your exports. So there. Then we got the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. The purpose of this thing was to supply failing businesses, mainly railroads and banks, with emergency low-interest loans. It later was involved in lending to the states for unemployment relief and for public works projects. So this is another example of a government intervention. Rothbard shows that some of these emergency low-interest loans went to institutions that just happened to be in good favor with the White House and with the party in power. So not too surprising, I suppose. Historian Paul Johnson says the businesses Hoover hoped to save either went bankrupt in the end anyway after fearful agonies or were burdened throughout the 1930s with a crushing load of debt. So it may have been better, in other words, to let these businesses go bankrupt so that other firms could get control of their assets cheaply and without being burdened by debt. Then taxes were raised. You got modest income tax reductions in 1929, but major increases in 1932, in the Revenue Act of 1932. Top marginal income tax rate increased from 25% to 63%. You got new or higher taxes in the cases of corporate taxes, estate taxes, gift taxes, taxes on cars, tires, gasoline, toiletries, electric energy, luxury items, bank checks, and telephone and telegraph messages. So obviously this is not a good thing for the economy. Public works programs. There were more funds expended in 4 years. The 4 years of Herbert Hoover's administration than there had been in the previous 20 on public works projects. So again, the idea that the government was doing nothing is provably false. Moreover, the federal government subsidized, that is actively supported with money, shipbuilding at a time when shipping was suffering a decline thanks to a shrinking of international trade caused by the Smoot-Hawley tariff. So there's much less international trade going on, much less need for shipping, and that's the moment the government's going to subsidize shipping. Now, Hoover, in his own memoir, recalled as follows, "We might have done nothing," which is what most people think he did because that's what we hear over and over and over again. Hoover did nothing. He was a stupid head. He believed in capitalism and so on. Now, I haven't even talked about his agriculture policy, all kinds of other areas too. His involvement in whether it was anything from immigration to bans on short selling of stock, etc. He says, "We might have done nothing. That would have been utter ruin. Instead, we met the situation with proposals to private business and to Congress of the most gigantic program of economic defense and counterattack ever evolved in the history of the Republic." John Nance Garner, the vice presidential nominee under Hoover's opponent in 1932, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, said, "Hoover is leading the country down the road to socialism." So at the time, nobody was foolish enough to say, well, Hoover believes in the free market and that's his problem. No, his critics were saying he's leading the country down the road to socialism. His problem is not that he's doing too little. His problem is doing way too much and interfering with the adjustment of the economy. Rexford Tugwell, who was an important advisor to Franklin Roosevelt, later recalled, "We didn't admit it at the time, but practically the whole New Deal was extrapolated from programs that Hoover started." All right, let's now look at the successor of Herbert Hoover, and that is Franklin Roosevelt, elected in 1932. So what I want to do is go through a few of the better known aspects of the bundle of programs introduced by Franklin Roosevelt that were known as the New Deal. And the first of these was called the National Industrial Recovery Act. And this act established something called the National Recovery Administration. And the thinking behind this act was that what business needed right now was not too much competition with each other, was not a race to compete to see who could get the lowest price and so on. What we need is stability. We need to give everybody a share of the market. So we're going to establish minimum prices for products, not maximum prices. Sell as high as you want. We're going to establish minimum prices. You have to sell your goods for at least this much. Now, notice that on the one hand, each industry was allowed to draft a production code for itself. And in each of these production codes, you would have stipulated minimum wages. So everybody's got to be paid at least a certain amount. Minimum prices, you have to charge at least a certain amount for your product. Hours of production that everybody in the industry will abide by. Production methods, etc. If you don't comply with the production code, you could be penalized. And then Roosevelt would pass these codes into law by executive order. Now, you may be wondering, if all the firms in an industry get together and decide together what their minimum prices are going to be and all that, that sounds like collusion. I mean, doesn't that sound like something that the antitrust laws, you know, were created to stop? And it turns out they had to suspend the antitrust laws to allow business firms to collaborate with each other in this way. Now, notice how contradictory it all is. On the one hand, we're going to try and keep people's wages high so that they'll have purchasing power to go out and buy things they need. But on the other hand, we're also trying to keep prices high. We're trying to keep minimum prices. We're trying to prevent people from having sales and cutting prices. No. We're going to keep prices up. So yeah, we're going to keep your wage up, but a lot of good that's going to do you if we're going to also raise prices. And also, these minimum wages, you know, you hear minimum wage, you think McDonald's. But in these days, these minimum wages under the National Industrial Recovery Act were 90% of the average wage around 1928. So this wasn't like the kind of money you'd earn in a fast food restaurant. These were very high minimum wages. And so unemployment continued in the double digits throughout the 1930s. So as I said before, the claim was that business needs stability, not too much competition. Then they'll be able to hire, earn profits, etc. Well, you can decide for yourself if that is a good idea or not. But here's an interesting example. My friend Bert Folsom, who's a professor of history at Hillsdale College, has a very good book called New Deal or Raw Deal about the domestic policy of Franklin Roosevelt. He's got some very, very good detail, just for instance, about the tire industry. He points out, he's got several industries, but I'm focusing on the tire industry. He points out exactly what the effects of the National Recovery Administration were on this particular industry. In particular, he was interested in the effects it would have on smaller businesses. What were the big businesses in the tire industry at that time? Well, Goodyear, Goodrich, and Firestone. Some of these may be familiar to you even today. Well, the big businesses tended to have the most influence when drawing up the production code for the industry. So the big tire companies had the most influence when drawing up the production code for the tire industry. And so one of the things they did was make sure and establish a fairly high minimum price. No one can sell lower than this number of dollars. No one can sell tires for less than this number of dollars. So tire prices went up. So this is not pro-consumer. And now notice what the effects of this are going to be on smaller businesses. Now, smaller businesses, a smaller tire company or repair company can't compete with Goodyear on the basis of service. Goodyear has service stations all over the country. Joe's Garage has one location. So Joe's Garage can't compete with Goodyear on service, because if I drive 100 miles, there's no Joe's Garage, and now what am I going to do? Whereas I can find a Goodyear every 50 miles, let's say. So how does Joe's Garage compete with Goodyear? You know, how does Joe's tire company, Joe's car, whatever, how do they compete with Goodyear? And the answer is on the basis of price. Joe's can sell tires for less than Goodyear. That's how Joe carves out a space in the market for himself, is by competing on price. He can't compete on service, but he can compete on price, but not anymore. Under the National Industrial Recovery Act, not anymore. He cannot compete on price because you're not allowed to lower your prices. This is where prices must be at least. This is what the big firms have said they've got to be when establishing the tire code. So you can't sell for down here. You can sell for here or higher. You can't sell for down here. And so this makes it very hard for small businesses to be competitive. In the Folsom book, by the way, he has testimonies from small businessmen saying exactly this. We can't compete on service. We can only compete on price. And now they won't let us compete on price. Clarence Darrow, whom you may know, whose name you may know from the Scopes trial from 1925, led an investigation into the NRA in 1934. And he concluded this. In virtually all the codes we have examined, one condition has been persistent. The code has offered an opportunity for the more powerful interests to seize control of an industry or to augment and extend a control already obtained. William Lichtenberg, who's a historian who favors the New Deal, so I'm not cherry-picking here, he's inclined to favor what Roosevelt did, admitted that the NRA did little to speed recovery and probably actually hindered it by its support of restrictionism and price raising, because it restricted the amount you could produce and sell. It wouldn't allow prices to be lower, so it obviously was interfering with the price system and with the normal adjustment of the market. Harold Cole and Lee Ohanian are a couple of professors I mentioned last time. I think at least Ohanian is not at UCLA anymore, but he was at the time he wrote this article. And he said this, and they wrote a famous article on the New Deal in the Journal of Political Economy, which is one of the most influential academic journals in that field. And they say this: New Deal labor and industrial policies did not lift the economy out of the depression as President Roosevelt had hoped. Instead, the joint policies of increasing labor's bargaining power and linking collusion with paying high wages prevented a normal recovery. Not only did the adoption of these industrial and trade policies coincide with the persistence of depression through the late 1930s, but the subsequent abandonment of these policies coincided with the strong economic recovery of the 1940s. Then in agriculture, we have the Agricultural Adjustment Act. The purpose of this act is to help the farmers. The argument is that the farmers aren't getting high enough prices for their crops. They're not able to make a good living at the prices they're able to get for their crops. So let's do what we need to do to raise the prices of crops. Well, think of, what do you think could be done to raise the prices of crops? Like, for example, when you hear that there, let's say there was a frost in Florida and a lot of the oranges were ruined, what's the effect on orange juice prices? Well, of course, up. Prices go up because there are fewer oranges. Orange juice, therefore, will be more scarce, and this is going to raise prices to higher than they would have been otherwise. So, in other words, if something happens to the size of the crop, it will raise prices. So that's to say, if the size of the crop shrinks, prices will go up. Roosevelt wants to raise prices for the farmer. So what's he going to do? He wants there to be a smaller crop. He wants there to be less produced. And then prices will go up in the same way as in my orange juice example. The problem he faces in 1933 is that it's too late for a policy like that. Farmers are already sitting on a big glut of agricultural production. Now, of course, it could be that maybe the market just had too many farmers in it, that maybe people needed to go do something else for a living. And then you would have had somewhat less production and prices would have gone to wherever they need to go. This would have been handled automatically on the market. Instead of saying, nope, we're going to keep everybody who's in farming. Well, you know, the market sometimes has a way of telling people, you shouldn't be in this field. We have too many people in this field. Go into something else. But the government was going to freeze everybody in farming where they were and just assure them that they would get prices up. Eventually, Roosevelt is going to favor a policy of reducing acreage. You just plant less in the first place, and then less will be produced, but that will raise prices and that'll be great. But the problem is in 1933, it's too late for that policy because there's already a glut of production. They've already produced all this cotton. They've already produced all this wheat, all this corn, etc. It's already been produced. It's too late to say we won't produce as much next year. What are we going to do about this year's production? So the answer is we'll just take a lot of this year's production and just destroy it. We'll just burn it. And that's how we'll deal with the overproduction from the alleged overproduction from this year. We'll just burn a good portion of it, and then the remainder will be more expensive, and this will be good. So you have enormous quantities of acres of cotton that are destroyed, and wheat destroyed, and millions of pigs slaughtered to raise the pork price. Now, this is at a time when people are having trouble feeding themselves, and the government's policy is to kill pigs and to destroy cotton for clothing, to destroy other foodstuffs in order to raise prices. So on the one hand, they're trying to keep wages up for people, but then on the other hand, then they think only about the farmers for a minute. What would the farmers want? They'd want higher farm prices, so we'll give that to them. Okay, and then the business people want higher prices for their products, so we'll just think about them and we'll raise prices for them. And so we're going to help each individual group as if it's a hermetically sealed part of the economy. But when you look at it together, what has all this accomplished? You raise their wages, then you cancel that out by raising the prices of everything they buy. And when you engage in acreage limitation, by the way, what farmers tend to do to get around this is they'll say, well, you know, some of these acres were barely producing for me anyway, so I just won't use those acres. I'll use my best acres, and then I'll cultivate the heck out of them and fertilize and everything. So they'll be able to produce more than the government is expecting them to be able to produce. So they have ways of getting around this. Well, what happens when the government suddenly says, hey, we don't want as much stuff produced. We need you to take all these acres out of production. Well, think about people who work for a living on those acres, producing food or, you know, growing cotton or whatever. What happens to them when all of a sudden one third of the acres aren't being cultivated anymore? Well, a lot of those people are going to have no job. There's nothing for them to do anymore. So they will be artificially unemployed. So as many as 2 million tenant farmers and sharecroppers lost their jobs. The U.S. Department of Agriculture engaged in a study in which they constructed four sample diets: liberal, moderate, minimum, and emergency, below subsistence. Subsistence is just enough food to stay alive. That's subsistence. Well, they found that the United States was not producing enough food to sustain its population, even at the minimum, that is subsistence diet. And yet, they're destroying food. Then we have the Works Progress Administration, which is going to engage in public works as Herbert Hoover had. And this is a program where you do have to think in terms of what is seen and what is not seen. We see the people working on building the bridge, but we don't see where the money would have gone otherwise into some other field, hiring people to do something else. Now, what's particularly noteworthy here, and that a number of scholars have taken particular note of, is that there seems to be a problem. There's an anomaly here in the Works Progress Administration. Why is it that the South, the Southern states, where people were the poorest, got the least assistance from the WPA? There were the fewest WPA projects begun there. Why is that? Why were the preponderance of WPA projects in the Western states? Well, it turns out that it was in the Western states that FDR's electoral margin had been thin in 1932, where he had just barely won. Whereas in the South, he was totally secure. The Southern states hadn't voted for a Republican, basically pretty much ever. Ever since Reconstruction, they had made pretty clear that no Republican was going to be elected in the South. They were the solid South. They voted Democrat. Again and again and again, the South voted Democrat. So the argument that some scholars have made is that Franklin Roosevelt realizes that the South is going to vote for him no matter what he does. Doesn't matter. He could run around naked, wouldn't matter. The South would vote for him. He's a Democrat. So why should he bother wasting his precious resources on WPA projects in the South when they're going to vote for him no matter what he does to them? Whereas on the other hand, it's not so clear. that the West will continue to vote for him. He only barely won out there, so he's really going to need his WPA projects out there to, in effect, bribe them into voting for him. That is what numerous scholars have said. Gavin Wright, for example, John Joseph Wallace, Jim F. Couch, and William Shugart have all claimed this. They've noted a significant correlation between New Deal spending and Franklin Roosevelt's political needs. Now, what about the argument that you'll sometimes hear there was a lot of government spending during the 1930s, and this led to economic recovery, that Franklin Roosevelt was not afraid to run government budget deficits, to spend more money than he brought in taxes? That's what stimulated the economy, the willingness to spend money the government didn't have, to borrow money and spend it. That's what got the economy moving again. Whereas Hoover had been too stingy, he hadn't spent enough government money, and the economy had languished. Well, leaving aside whether spending government money is a good thing for the economy or not, we can just look at this. First of all, economist Christina Romer, who had been one of the chief economic advisors to Barack Obama, has made this claim. But we can't accept this claim, though, because it was in fiscal year 1933 when the economy hit the lowest point of the Depression. The deficit at that time, the government budget deficit, was 4.5% of GDP. In the first 3 years of the New Deal, so the 3 years after that, every year it averaged 5.1% of GDP. Well, it seems pretty unlikely that the deficit goes up by 0.6 percentage points, and we're supposed to believe that's what did it. That's what took us from the worst economy ever to the beginnings of recovery. You just increase the deficit by this much, and it makes all the difference in the world. Maybe there's something else going on here. It turns out that the recovery was already underway before Franklin Roosevelt took office. It was already underway under Hoover. So all he had to do was sit there, and he could take credit for it. So it has nothing whatsoever to do with the government budget deficits. If government budget deficits would have helped, then Herbert Hoover's 4.5% of GDP should have helped. But instead, that was the worst year of all. So in other words, my point here is that the size of the deficits, there's so little difference between the size of the deficit at the end of Hoover's term and at the beginning of Roosevelt's that it can't possibly be an explanatory factor in why things gradually got better. We did see some economic growth in the 1930s. The difference is so small and trivial, it can't possibly account for this. Also, if such a small shift in government spending, just a tiny little bit, makes the difference between the worst depression ever under Hoover and the beginnings of recovery under FDR, then what would happen when government spending was cut after World War II? After World War II, government spending was cut by two-thirds. Dramatic cut. So if lower government spending is supposed to lead to terrible outcomes, Herbert Hoover didn't spend enough, that's why we had a terrible outcome, then after World War II, we should have had the worst outcome of all. We've never seen the government budget get slashed so severely. And in fact, the economic historian Robert Gordon says, in the summer of 1945, the belief was fairly widely held in Washington that unemployment would be a serious problem during the winter of 1945 to 46. So when everybody realized World War II is coming to an end, there were a lot of economists who, to their eternal discredit, warned that, oh no, if the government cuts back on spending, we'll all be unemployed. But you know what? It turns out that other people will spend that money and employ you. The economist Alvin Hansen in the middle of the war said, when the war is over, the government can't just disband the army, close down munitions factories, stop building ships, and remove all economic controls. But you know what? That is exactly what the U.S. government did. That is exactly what it did, word for word. That's what it did. And what happened? Did the economy collapse? Because again, if we're supposed to believe that a fall in government spending, or that a small amount of government spending means bad economic times, but when you boost economic government spending, that means good economic times, well, then it should work in reverse too. If you cut the government budget, that should send us tumbling back to bad economic times. And yet, 1946 was the single greatest year for the private economy, that is, leaving out the public sector, the private economy, in all of American history. The economy had always recovered in the past from all other previous downturns. Why was this recovery so slow? You did see economic growth. The economy did grow in the 1930s, but joblessness remained frustratingly high all throughout the 30s. How do we account for this? And one of the explanations that's been given comes from the economic historian Robert Higgs, a very, very accomplished historian and economist. And Higgs talked about something called regime uncertainty. If business firms do not have confidence in the stability of political life, if they don't have confidence that the government will do the right thing, or they don't have confidence that they can predict what the government's going to do, or they feel like the government is erratic, it's doing one thing, then another, like experimenting with the economy, or if the government is virulently anti-business, well, all these things put together may lead businesses to say, you know what, now is not a time to invest in expanding our company. Now's a time to hunker down and hope for better times. That's exactly what happened. Higgs says, given the unparalleled outpouring of business-threatening laws, regulations, and court decisions, the oft-stated hostility of President Roosevelt and his lieutenants toward investors as a class, and the character of the anti-business zealots who composed the strategists and administrators of the New Deal from 1935 to 1941, the political climate could hardly have failed to discourage some investors from making fresh long-term commitments. He calls this regime uncertainty. And as I said, from 1933 to 1940, the average unemployment rate remained at 18%. So the problem went on and on and on. So it is not true to say that the New Deal got the country out of the Great Depression. And of course it's not true to say World War II got the economy out of the Great Depression. We already talked about war and the economy. We saw that the years of World War II were times of impoverishment for the American public. No, for what really got the country back out of the Depression, I refer you to your reading for today, which covers that very topic. So this has been a kind of fresh look at the New Deal, not the standard view, but a view that is upheld by an increasing number of modern scholars. So thanks for watching.
All right, folks, before we wrap up for the weekend, let me tell you about a podcast that a member of my supporting listeners group has started, and it's terrific. It's called Cannabis Heals Me, and it's stories of people who have used medical cannabis and have had great results. And she says, I'm convinced more than ever after learning as much as I've learned that government should have no say in what we put in our bodies. I've shared the stories from my podcast with my state legislators and skeptical friends, and I've seen their stance on prohibition soften. So she says, I hope this podcast will not only help people see cannabis differently, but then take that observation a step further to realize we don't need government protecting us from things that seem dangerous. She's got some terrific stories of people with just intractable health problems that went away because of medical cannabis use. Very, very interesting indeed. You can check out that podcast at cannabishealsme.com, linked, of course, as the listener website mentioned, at tomwoods.com/1353. And of course, as always, remember, you can get nice publicity like this, plus my video tutorials helping you become a blogger really quickly, getting you trained in WordPress, plus a link on my site, which helps you with your SEO, and membership in my private bloggers group where we help each other out. How do you get all those nice bonuses? Well, make sure you get your hosting through my link, and you'll get all these neat bonuses. Details on everything can be found at tomwoods.com/publicity. See you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.